Good morning and welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly recap of local news from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard across the state thanks to Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, changes are made to the law creating a so-called inland port, but the process is not to everyone's liking. Utah reaction to the president's comments in Helsinki and his effort to walk back those comments. And a donation from the Mormon Church intended to help prevent LGBTQ suicides leads to a resignation. Joining me for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune religion reporter Peggy Fletcher Stack is in studio with us. Peggy, so glad you're here. Welcome.
Thank you.
Also, Salt Lake Tribune news and politics editor Dan Harry is here with us. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning.
And columnist Robert Gerke is with us as well. Welcome to you, Robert.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Listeners, you can join us with your comments and questions by posting them to sltrib.com or calling us up. We are at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Peggy Fletcher Stack, we've just got you for a little while today, and so we will begin with a story that you covered this week about the resignation of one of the heads of an LGBTQ support organization. It's an organization that works with members and former members of the Mormon Church within the LGBTQ community. Kimberly Anderson was vice president of this group, Affirmation. Peggy, why did she resign?
Kimberly is a transgender woman in the Bay Area, former Mormon. And the donation, $25,000, was meant to be used as suicide prevention, for suicide prevention training.
And this is a donation from the Mormon Church to this group.
From the church to the group specifically for this training. And although Kimberly doesn't have a problem with Affirmation accepting donations from the LDS Church in general, she just found it, as she said, morally reprehensible to accept a donation specifically targeted to suicide prevention when it is her view that LDS teachings themselves are possibly causes of some people's, at least part of their cause for committing suicide. And so for her, she just felt that was a kind of a bridge too far and that it was not an acceptable donation.
And again, this is the Mormon Church made this kind of historic donation to Affirmation,
exactly.
$25,000, and it was earmarked, as you said, for suicide prevention training. Can you speak to what the debate looked like inside of Affirmation, Peggy, about accepting this gift from the LDS Church? Was it controversial when it came in? Did they think about it?
It's actually, apparently, if you listen to our podcast, Mormonland,
yeah,
the two, the president and the executive director of Affirmation talked about the fact that they actually approached the LDS Church and asked for the money because they've been trying to do this. The suicide training is not a church-sponsored training. It's a generally accepted best practices training, and they wanted money to train their people. And so someone said, well, go to the LDS Church. They have money, and this is a good thing. And so they did, and they thought it wouldn't, and then were sort of surprised that the church agreed. And they at first did not think it would be controversial. But the board, Affirmation's board, which is fairly sizable, it's about, with the executive committee and all the board members, it's 18 people. And as Carson Tuller, the president, told us, after the discussions, there's probably no one on the board who wasn't a little conflicted about this donation for the very same reasons as Kimberly, which is really, we know that church teachings make LGBTQ Mormons feel unwelcome, feel there's no place for them in this life or the next, and that contributes to their feelings of worthlessness, etc. So that, yeah, there was totally conflict, and none of them, though they're sad to see Kimberly go, they understand, and they're not angry or critical of her.
Can you, Peggy? Can you remind us what the church says about people who are gay? What is the doctrinal, or maybe what is the position that the church takes on this community?
Okay. The LDS Church says that it is not a sin to be same-sex attracted, but The policy is you have to be, if you are, you have to be celibate, or you could be in a mixed orientation marriage, meaning a gay man could marry a straight woman or something. In the eternities, however, everyone at the highest level will be in an opposite sex marriage. You don't get to heaven by yourself, in other words. And again, that makes gay members, gay and lesbian, et cetera, members feel unwelcome, like there's no place. And furthermore, in November 2015, the church announced a policy wherein those in same-sex marriages are deemed to be apostates, and their children are barred from any of the church rituals until they're 18 or older and disavow their parents' marriage. Well, that was harsh. And so both the eternities and the here, many LGBTQ Mormons feel really unwelcome.
It sounds like what you're saying is that, you know, another way of stating the church position is that you can essentially be who you are, just don't act on it. Like it.
Yeah. Right.
And that's distinct from saying, you know, you are inherently or intrinsically sinning by being who you are. This is a
right. They've made that clear. The church has made that clarification that it is not a sin to have these feelings and attractions, only to act on them. But at some level, it ends up being kind of the same thing. There's a feeling among many LGBT Mormons that they are somehow not whole, or they're an aberration, or it's a handicap. And I think, as those two men told us on Mormonland, one of their big goals for affirmation is to try to have this engaged in this dialogue with the church to help say, look, we are not abnormal. We are not broken or flawed. We are who God created us to be.
Does the church and this LGBTQ organization, Affirmation, do they have a relationship beyond this, them, you know, Affirmation having gone to the LDS church and asking for this donation? I mean, is there something stronger there?
Well, they're building a dialogue and an engagement, and they spoke to, the leader spoke to why they think that's a good thing to have this ongoing dialogue. They feel that they can hold the church accountable for some of its statements and policies if they're in dialogue. Whereas if they walk away, they feel that they will not have any impact going forward. And that's not uncontroversial. Plenty of people in Affirmation feel that they in no way should have these conversations or involvement. And I can see, you know, why they say that.
Is the donation by the LDS Church to a group like Affirmation, is it a sign of anything bigger going on inside of the church when it comes to its stance on or maybe its treatment of homosexuality?
It's been evolving slowly over time. Last summer, for example, the LDS Church endorsed Love Loud, a concert that was a fundraiser for Encircle, which is a home in Provo that helps LGBT people. And that was kind of a little bit surprising. And so there are these outreach efforts on both sides to try to say, we probably are not going to change our policies, but let's try to humanize our rhetoric and our involvement.
I want to bring, let's first off invite listeners again to join this conversation. You can call 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. But I would like to bring an editorial voice in on this conversation for a moment. Robert Gerke, circling back to something that Peggy pointed out, the stance that the Mormon Church takes on gay people. And, you know, essentially the idea being that it's okay to be gay, just don't act on it. To borrow a word, that isn't exactly an affirmation of a person. I'd love to get your take on this donation from the church to the group Affirmation and then this resignation, I guess.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess it's good that the church is coming up with some money to try to help curb the suicide rate. I mean, Utah, generally speaking, has one of the highest suicide rates in the country, and given our predominant Mormon culture, you've got to see that there are a number of Mormon youth in particular who are taking their own lives, and that's unfortunate. It's particularly the rates are high among young people, and the rates are high among the LGBT community, and it needs to be addressed. I think so I guess the money is nice. Some policy acknowledgments would be probably more beneficial, because you know Peggy mentioned this Encircle house. Part of the reason Encircle exists is because LGBT kids are thrown out of their homes by parents who believe that they're flawed, you know, and they're driven away. And so the fact that that has to exist, it shows us that we have a deeper problem. And so, and this policy toward, you know, the disavowing your parents, you know, having to disavow your same-sex parents is not a welcoming environment for these kids to be in. And the fact that you are told from, if you have same-sex attraction from a young age, that you can never have a companion, you know, of the same gender, because, you know, it's somehow less than, I guess, you know, it's the church needs to come to grips with these policies, because they're doing an incredible amount of damage to LGBT Mormons, driving them away from the church in many cases, driving them, you know, and in some cases driving them to suicide. And so, you know, the money is nice, I guess. It's not a lot of money for a church this size, and I don't know how far that's going to go, but they need to, you know, at some point they're going to need to take a careful look at their policies on these issues and the impacts and the fallout they're having.
Peggy, this as you know, this donation was earmarked for suicide prevention efforts. And as Robert points out, this is a vulnerable population. I'm reminded that Utah Governor Gary Herbert convened a suicide prevention task force that included, I think it was a youth suicide prevention task force that included Ronald A. Rasband, who is a member of the church's Quorum of the 12 Apostles, as well as Equality Utah Executive Director Troy Williams, Equality Utah being an LGBTQ rights organization. I guess what I'm wondering is this donation part of a larger suicide prevention action from inside of the church? Are they, I mean, $25,000, as Robert points out, isn't a lot of money for an organization of this size, but are they taking this seriously?
I would say yes. It is part of a recognition by the church that that suicide is a problem and among its own people, as Robert says. And I think that is one reason. I seem to recall that's one of the reasons that the Affirmation officers approached the church in the first place, because they knew it was already on record saying it wanted to be involved in suicide prevention exactly because of this. And the church is, it's not just the LGBTQ population, of course, it's the entire population of Utah, and many of whom are LDS. So yeah, it's part of a broader approach.
Okay. You know, whenever we talk about suicide, it's important to give people access to resources. And one resource that has been helpful to a lot of people is the National Suicide Prevention Hotline. The number is 800-273-TALK. Again, that's 800-273-8255. Just before we head to a break, Peggy, and I know that you have to run as well, I don't know if you can speak to this, actually, but another group that has worked on bridging divides between the Mormon Church and the LGBTQ community is Mormons Building Bridges. They're a grassroots group that wants to improve attitudes between those two sides. Every year, for a number of years now, they have applied to be part of the 24th of July, the Days of 47 parade. This year, again, they were rejected. Parade organizers said once again that they are an advocacy group and that disqualifies them. Does that at all play into the conversation that we've been having, Peggy? The parade is not the church, obviously. The church is separate from it, but it is a big supporter of this parade, and it's a big event. How does that play into the conversation about the church and its attitudes, or is it not part of that?
It's a little separate, but similar. The Mormons Building Bridges argues it's not an advocacy group, that it's really simply trying to build bridges, and speaks to a large population on either side of this issue. But the parade obviously has made a different decision. The presence of Mormons Building Bridges, the work of that group, which has been around for, I don't know, half a dozen years, has also raised the visibility of this issue and helped members of the LDS Church who want to be more open and more understanding and have better communication and empathy and et cetera. So it's, you know, it's
part of a dialogue, I guess.
Yeah. So it's not the same thing as affirmation, but it's in the same arena, I guess you would say.
Gerkey, before we head to a break, comments on the rejection of Mormons building bridges again from the days of 47.
I mean, I think Peggy hit on sort of the irony of this is that if they are indeed an advocacy group, if you accept that line, they're advocating for more communication, which I don't think is something that's super controversial. It's not like they're taking a polarizing political stance. They're saying, let's get along better, which is that's like Sesame Street, right? you know. And if frankly, if the Days of 47 parade is going to get permits from the city and then discriminate against groups with unpopular political viewpoints, then maybe the city should not be permitting the parade and just get rid of it altogether.
Well, it's interesting because this does follow on the heels of Provo accepting.
Exactly. The exact same.
Legally speaking, I don't know if it's exactly the same. I mean, you saw the. The Freedom Festival, they get about $450,000, I think, of public money. I mean, direct public subsidy. And the Days of 47 people, for legal purposes, are very careful not to take state money.
But they just took several million dollars to build a new rodeo stadium.
Yes, exactly.
So they are getting subsidized.
And about the same time that group split into two nonprofits, one dealing with the rodeo and the other with the parade. So they're following the legal guidelines on this. Whether they should do it is a different question, as
correct.
You point out.
Yeah.
Well, guys, we have to head to a break, but Salt Lake Tribune religion reporter Peggy Fletcher Stack, it has been a privilege having you here. Thanks very much for joining us on
Always
the show.
Always a pleasure.
Hope to bring you back in someday soon. You are listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We need to head to our first break of the show. When we return, we will talk about changes to the Inland Port Bill from this week's special legislative session. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I am joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune News and Politics editor Dan Harry and by columnist Robert Gerkey. This is our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments. Post them at the Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com or call us at 801-355-8255. Dan Harry, let's turn to the special session of the state legislature that took place Wednesday. The biggest news item there was the Inland Port. It's being called the largest development project in Utah history. But there have been some sticking points since the unveiling of the bill that authorized it during this last legislative session in from January to March. And then a compromise was struck that led to this week's special session, a compromise between some parties anyway. Where are we, Dan, with the Inland Port? We have a revised bill authorizing the port. What are those revisions?
Well, yeah, they did change the bill from March, which left Salt Lake City feeling like it had been blindsided and basically its power hijacked from it by the state. And so the city council negotiated behind closed doors for several months, and they did get some concessions in this bill. The boundaries are smaller. I think it's now around 16,000 acres rather than 20. They did get an agreement that any services that the city provides to the area, you know, police or public utilities, other services, would be reimbursed to the city. There were some wetlands withdrawn from this area. So they did get some concessions.
How about taxes? How taxes are allocated from this project?
Yeah, I don't think that changed a lot. Like I said, they did get an agreement that the city would be reimbursed for a cost to it. Hmm. But in general, the major points of the Inland Port proposal are still intact. And, state leaders, like you said, are hailing this as a terrific victory, and this is part of Utah's future moving ahead.
Let's talk about public input on this. There hasn't been a lot of that. I mean, I've read a few letters to the editor in the Salt Lake Tribune, but in terms of formal comments from the public on this piece of legislation?
Well, that's one of the problems. There really hasn't been any format for that. The first bill that came out of the legislative session had been, you know, the subject of public hearings and a lot of negotiation, and there was a lot of public debate about it. And then it got to the House after passing the Senate, and the House substituted its own bill, which had been, you know, not debated in public, and they didn't debate it at all. They took 15 minutes to vote on it, kind of jammed it through on the next to last night of the session, and then the Senate, surprising a lot of people, just went ahead without debate and accepted those changes. So that bill that passed in March actually had had no public hearings because the House bill was a very different version.
Right.
So now we come along months later and they said, okay, we're going to fix it and we're going to, you know, do this publicly and have a lot of public input. Well, the city council had a lot of input, but, you know, normal people, residents, didn't have much of any input. They had one public hearing on Wednesday, and the chairman, for whatever reason, decided that, you know, they should stick with their original agenda and talk about storage rental for 25 minutes.
Right.
And so when they finally got to the port bill to try to keep an orderly process, as he said, the chairman restricted people to speaking 1 minute at a time on this. What can you say in a minute?
Not a lot, unless you're an auctioneer.
You can't even explain what an inland port is in a minute.
Well, and limited public comment has also been a complaint that Salt Lake City Mayor Jackie Biskupski has, among other things. She also points to the years of study that have gone into things like the Point of the Mountain development around Draper. She says that is not happening here. We should also say that she dropped out of these negotiations altogether. Dan.
She dropped out. I mean, I guess you would sort of describe what the mayor did as a boycott, right? Mm-hmm. She had been in discussions with the governor, and it looked like they were getting close to an agreement, and then for whatever reason that collapsed, and she's basically boycotted the discussions ever since. In fact, gotten to the point where she's forbade staff members to give information and provide requested information to city council members who were continuing negotiations. So they sometimes went to the county to get that kind of information they were looking for. So that was sort of a strange thing. And then the mayor did reemerge Wednesday to testify, you know, against the bill. She does, I would say, you know, she has a legitimate point making this comparison with what's going on at Point of the Mountain, the site of the old prison, and what's going on here with the inland port is, you know, they have bent over backwards to have public input on that Point of the Mountain, and it's turned over to an Envision Utah, and they're doing all these public hearings and public meetings. None of that occurred with this.
Years of planning for Draper on Point of the Mountain, but this is being called the largest development in state history. The fact that I'm going to turn this over to Robert Gerke, but the fact that there has been such limited sort of planning, public-facing planning anyways, doesn't seem very deliberative. Robert Gerke, do you want to comment on that?
No, it doesn't. I mean, there have been a couple community council meetings, I guess, hearings, and the community is actually pretty much opposed to this, you know, to this idea and the way it's been done. And so, I mean, I think the mayor's taking a kind of a risk in not participating in the negotiations, but at the same time, she probably recognizes that she, you know, doesn't want to negotiate with a gun to her head because the legislature, A, has already done what it wants to do, and so getting concessions from them, you're just basically begging. You have no, it's not a dialogue, it's a plea, I guess, that the city council got. The changes they made are fairly minor, you know, in terms of the state is still taking all the tax revenue from the development of the port, and then we'll give some of it back to the city, which, you know, was sort of the plan all along, I guess. The boundary changes are mostly cosmetic because the wetlands that were taken out of the port area were already kind of off limits, but under an agreement with the developers and the city. Plus, if they would go into those areas, it's going to cause them more headaches with the Army Corps of Engineers and wetlands preservation than it would you know benefit. So the appeals process is basically the same. I mean, the city gets the first crack at any resolving any disputes, but at the end of the day, it's still the Port Authority Board that's going to adjudicate all of those. While the city council did get some, I guess, window dressing on it, they're not substantive changes, and it's not what the city wants, but the city's not going to get what it wants. The legislature has made clear that they're plowing ahead with this.
Dan, on these negotiations that the city council participated in, but again, the mayor did not participate in, is it sort of that the council members understand that the state has very much taken control on this and that they have all the power, the state has all the power, and so better to kind of try and mitigate what the state might do at this point early in the process, rather than just let it happen. Although what Robert Gerke is saying is that it's kind of window dressing. I don't know.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think Robert portrayed it correctly that they didn't have a lot of negotiating power. They didn't have any leverage. And that's what happens when you pass a bill, acknowledge that it's flawed, and then say, oh, we'll come back and fix it. And, you know, we've seen this before. We saw that in the DUI bill. The legislature passed, the governor signed a DUI bill taking it down to the legal limit to 0.5 and said, oh, yeah, we know there's problems with this bill. We'll come back and fix it. Well, when the hubbub kind of died down after a few months, they didn't fix it. The bill takes effect. And that's kind of what happened here. I mean, there were concessions. The city council members feel that they were legitimate concessions, but I don't think they feel satisfied with the end result by any means.
Well, and to kind of show where the legislature is coming from on this, Greg Hughes, Speaker Hughes, suggested that if the city doesn't like these changes, then the state could just annex the property altogether and take it away entirely from the city. That's a pretty draconian threat from the speaker, but also one that, you know, I've heard the annexation idea floated before in the Capitol, and it would be I think unprecedented. The end game, I think, for the city and what we need to watch now is whether they're going to sue over this.
Right.
The mayor threatened to sue the governor before when talks broke down. I would imagine that she still has that arrow in her quiver, and the question then is, does the council do something to try to prevent that?
Well, they have. They passed in the budget basically a prohibition on the mayor suing over this without permission of the city council. It's questionable whether that's constitutional, that they could prohibit the mayor from doing that.
She pointed out also that conceivably community organizations, nonprofit organizations might litigate this as well in a press release that she sent out. The West Side community councils were opposed to, I think, this bill. Did Salt Lake City Council represent them as well in these negotiations? Did anybody represent the West Side community councils who are, I would say, probably more directly impacted?
Well, I think, as Robert said, they had a couple of community meetings, but they were talking about concepts at that point. They didn't have a bill in front of them that they knew what was going to come out of the special session because it hadn't been drafted yet. So, you know, they got a couple of chances to express their opinions. But as I said, one of the community council members that tried to testify Wednesday, she was not able to ask the question because of the 1 minute limit. But what she wanted to ask is, why did you remove the provision that says one of the aims of this port will be to maintain the quality of life? That was removed. And her question was, why would anybody object to that?
Maintaining a high quality.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good question. As far as who can be on the Port Authority Board, was that impacted at all by this bill? Dan, Speaker Hughes had previously been on the board. He appointed himself to it. He had to resign.
Appointed himself to the board, yeah. which is kind of amazing. I don't recall anybody having done that before. You through legislation, you give yourself power to appoint board members, and then you appoint yourself to the board.
And had to step down.
Had to step down because there was a conflict of interest provision in the bill that said if you owned property within 5 miles of the boundaries of this port, that you could not be a board member. And he owned, I think, 9 properties that fell within the 5-mile limit. So then what he wanted to do was he wanted to change the law to remove that so he could stay on the board, and that wasn't going to fly. The governor and others were not going to permit that. So he finally saw the writing on the wall, stepped down, and appointed the majority whip, Francis Gibson, to that post. Hmm. They did make some provisions in the bill Wednesday to allow James Rogers, the city councilman, who does also own property within the area, to allow him to do that and be on the board. And also Carlos Braceros, who's the UDOT director, the transportation director for the state, because he negotiates property deals within the area. And so under the strict language, he would have been prohibited. But they allowed him to do that as well.
And is the board now set? I mean, I guess do we know all of the members of the board?
I think it's all set. I couldn't name them all.
Right. In terms of the contracts, in terms of like who gets the building contracts or operational contracts for this port, the board is going to decide who
the board is going to decide. Yeah.
Okay. Here's a question for you: Is U.S. Customs on board with this? You know, part of this is processing shipping containers here that have not passed customs at the coast. Has the Customs and Border Protection Agency signed off on this, Dan? Do we know?
I do not know that. I know that there are several of these so-called inland ports around the country, and so I think it's a fairly routine matter of getting your approvals. I'm sure they're going to have to go through some process to do that, but I can't imagine that would be a big obstacle to it.
Hmm. What's the next step here? I mean, we might see litigation, I guess, is a potential.
Yeah, just me saying this, but I would be surprised if we saw litigation. I guess it could happen. We'll see. But I think that the folks who are promoting this, and the governor is one of the big cheerleaders. They want to see this starting to go. So I'm imagining we're going to start seeing some deals cut and some construction out there, in addition to the prison that's going to be going out in this area that is being under construction right now.
Yeah, we saw that board, the first board meeting, the attempted board meeting, I guess, fall apart because of these concerns about the conflict of interest and whether they could actually be seated as members of the board. So I would anticipate we'll have board meetings coming soon. At the end of the day, the reason this thing has a rocket on its back, basically, is there are some pretty heavy hitters who are interested in developing this port area. And so I think, and politically connected people who have some large amounts of money that they're looking to make on this. And so, yeah, I think there's we're going to start seeing some development fairly quickly.
The seat at the trough, as it were. Mm-hmm. So, all right, the state's moving forward with this with the blessing of the Salt Lake City Council. But not with the blessing of the mayor's office, and we will keep watching it. We need to head to another quick break here, and then when we return, we will turn to how Utah politicos reacted to President Trump's comments at a summit with President Vladimir Putin. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Dan Harry and Robert Gerke. It's our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us by calling 801-355-8255 with your questions and comments. Well, Dan and Robert, the president made some comments about Russian election interference that directly contradicted the conclusions of U.S. intelligence agencies. This came during press comments at a summit with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Helsinki, Finland. I think we've all heard these comments, but as a reminder, he said that he didn't see any reason why it would be Russia. Afterwards, there was an uproar. How did Utah's delegation in Washington respond to this, Dan? Did any of them directly take the president to task for these comments?
Mildly, a couple of them did. But for the most part, what they did, leading with Orrin Hatch, they issued statements reaffirming their faith in the intelligence community's findings that Russia interfered with the 2016 election and that there was no question that that had happened. But they did not, for the most part, even mention the name of President Donald Trump. And it's kind of hard to imagine how you do that, how you criticize an action of somebody without talking about who that person is. But they did it. Chris Stewart, for one, who is a member of the House Intelligence Committee, did say the president was wrong. And that was the strongest statement that came out of Utah's delegation. Mm-hmm. Now, since then, Chris Stewart has been back to, you know, a major defender of the president. In fact, the other day on CNN, he said he loves this president. Mm-hmm. And this is Chris Stewart, who once called Donald Trump our Mussolini, but now he loves him.
And he's defending Trump for this this one-on-one meeting that the president had. It was between Trump and Putin, something that doesn't usually happen. It was just the two world leaders and their interpreters. He said that was essentially no big deal on this in the same interview.
He said it was no big deal. As far as we know, it's unprecedented that a president would meet with the leader of a hostile country with basically no backup there. The only two people in the room besides Putin and Donald Trump were the interpreters. And Democrats, of course, are making noise about calling the American interpreter to testify before Congress. But, you know, given the Republican majority's loyalty to the president, that is not going to happen.
I want to bring Robert Gerke into the conversation, but first, just when the president came back from Helsinki and then said that he misspoke, that he meant to use the word wouldn't instead of would, did our federal delegation buy that? I mean, you know, did they accept that explanation for the president's comments?
They haven't really spoken publicly since then, which probably means yes, they bought it. At least in the sense that they're not going to do anything about it.
Robert Gerke, this one-on-one meeting and also the comments that called into question, you know, what the intelligence community mm-hmm. in the United States says happened. There were recently 12 indictments of Russians by FBI Special Counsel Robert Mueller for targeting the United States in including election technology groups, the DNC, and so on, hacking that was happening. Your comments on this whole sort of imbroglio.
Well, it's kind of mind-boggling. First, let's start at the end when he tried to correct himself. I mean, if you read the full context of the press conference they had and what President Trump said about that, if changing the one word, it just doesn't make sense. You can't read it with that one word changed and not completely, you know, blur the context. It doesn't make sense for his argument that he misspoke. That said, I mean, it's disappointing. I mean, look, John McCain, who obviously has a history with Vladimir Putin, said that no prior American president has abased himself so abjectly as President Trump did in that meeting. It was astonishing to see. You know, because we have this long history in this country. You know, I grew up, you know, watching Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev, you know, locking horns, right? And this was far from locking horns. This was rolling over. And so, you know, it's and the United States has, first, if you can't be firm about another adversary hacking your election, how are you going to be firm about, you know, bombings in Syria and occupation of Crimea. It was, I think others called it a low point in American diplomatic history.
Well, what made it even more startling was this occurred right after he'd met with NATO allies and basically criticized and sort of was his usual gruff, insulting self to our allies. And then he has this summit and press conference with Vladimir Putin. And it was not only the words that came out of his mouth, but if you watch that, the body language mm-hmm. that the president displayed on that stage was remarkably weak and very unlike him, especially in the context of how we see him with other world leaders.
And yesterday the news came out that I guess Dan Coats found out about it during an interview he was doing that the president has invited Vladimir Putin to the White House, I guess, in the fall. It would be comical if it wasn't so frightening.
Hmm. Dan, what about the revelations that Trump had seen evidence of election tampering before he was inaugurated? He was shown actual evidence by intelligence officials. But he has since repeatedly expressed skepticism about Russia doing this. I don't know if I'm asking you to kind of put the words of our congressional delegation in Washington out here for us, but do they care that he's been denying that allegation or questioning that assertion?
Well, but they've been denying it themselves. I mean, Chris Stewart, again, as a member of the House Intelligence Committee, has seen much of the evidence that the intelligence agencies have compiled. And yet he's been denying, and I believe denies to this day, that we know that Russia interfered with the aim of helping Donald Trump's candidacy.
At this meeting, though, in Helsinki, Putin said
Putin said he did. Okay. He acknowledged it, but I don't know that Representative Stewart.
Putin acknowledged that he wanted Trump to win,
correct.
Right?
Not that he interfered to
right.
have Trump win.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. That was the desired outcome, was that Donald Trump win the presidency over Hillary Clinton.
And then there are these indictments of 12 Russians and additional Russians for election hacking. I want to get back to the meeting, the private meeting between Trump and Putin for a second, because and actually this plays into the comments that were made as well. Some Democrats have called for America's ambassador to Russia. This is former Utah Governor John Huntsman Jr. to come home and testify about the meeting. Maybe I'll go to Robert Gerke, because you wrote a column in which you said that Ambassador Huntsman should resign. You said that in the wake of these comments that Trump made. Why were you making that argument, Robert Gerke?
Well, because I don't think he can do his job anymore. I think, if your job is to be our man in Moscow and be firm with the Russians, and then you have the legs cut out from under you by your boss at every turn, then how are you supposed to represent American interests? How are you supposed to represent American interests when the president of the United States doesn't represent American interests? And I think it needs to be the comments from the president need to be strongly disavowed. And the best way to do that, I think, is for the ambassador to submit his resignation. Now, I have no indication that that's even in the cards. But I wasn't just me that
you weren't alone. That, yeah.
I wasn't alone. John Weaver, who was his chief campaign strategist when he ran for president in 2012, called on him to resign as well. Being ambassador to Russia is a very difficult job, and if you are doing it at odds with the president of the United States, it undermines the work that the people, the diplomats, the career diplomats in the embassy are putting into it. It undermines the work that the intelligence agencies have put into keep representing American interests. And so, if the president doesn't care, then, what are you doing there? It's going to what you asked about the testimony at the congressional hearing. I think there's a possibility that he will be called in to testify. He obviously can't testify about the meeting itself because he wasn't in the meeting. I believe that it was the New York Times that reported that there were firm commitments, verbal agreements made by the president with Vladimir Putin, but nobody knows what those are yet because there was nobody else there. So it's a little puzzling, and it's why we don't do it this way. It's why you have staff in there. It's why you have other, you know, other people in there with you.
So a record for history.
Yeah.
Just going back to the resignation, the call for resignation that you issued and that others issued, the Tribune editorial board, the Salt Lake Tribune editorial board disagreed with you, and they said that there was nobody more capable or patriotic than the ambassador and that he should stay where he is. And we should, of course, point out that his brother is the owner and publisher of the Tribune and sits on the editorial board. Mm-hmm. Their argument is one that I've heard made by others, though, which is essentially that it is your duty to stay and do what's right, you know, for the country, despite, you know, despite the fact that maybe that's difficult. Stay and be a force for good, if possible, is the idea.
Yeah. I get their argument that, you know, you need to be in the game to score points, right? So if he quits the job, then he leaves it to somebody who maybe isn't as capable as he is, who doesn't have the same commitment to doing the job that needs to be done. And so, you know, there is some logic to that argument, I think. You know, but and to be clear, Ambassador Huntsman has said all along that he does, you know, when your country calls, you answer the call, and that's why he's there. He feels this duty to his country. But I think in my counter argument to that was, your duty is to your country, not to a president who doesn't represent American values overseas. And if you really want to represent the country, you need to defend the country from this sort of. You know, from the Russian hostility. So, you know, I think the likelihood is that the ambassador will stick around because he probably sees the argument that, you know, he can't represent American interests in Russia if he's not the ambassador. So.
Okay. We are getting close to the end of the show here. And Dan, I wanted to squeeze in one more question about this, which is that Representative Chris Stewart, you mentioned, has questioned the idea of Russia being behind this hacking that has happened, or has sort of muddied the waters there a little bit. But does Robert Mueller, the FBI special counsel, does he have the support of our members of Congress, meaning Utah's elected officials in Washington, for the investigation that he is conducting?
Yeah, they've all said that they have no intention of supporting a movement to remove Mueller. They want the investigation to continue. So we haven't seen any of them, any of our members of Congress calling for that to end.
Hmm. Well, it feels a little like we're on this news cycle feels like we're on an amusement park ride with no breaks, and who knows what will come next. Guys, I think that we should turn to our underplayed stories of the week, our final segment of the show. And Dan Harry, I will start with you.
I am going to pick the ruling in favor of the Tribune, arguing that the Brigham Young University Police Department is, in fact, a police department and subject to GRAMA, the open records law. And
the context here is that the Trib had requested information or records pertaining to an arrest or no, to
Well, this was part of the investigation into whether the police were being involved in honor code violations,
right,
by sexual assault victims at BYU, and that there had been information sharing, and we had sought records to try to get to the bottom of that. And the BYU police said they're not a government agency subject to open records. They are going to appeal this. They want the courts to find that they are not subject to open records, so we'll see where this goes.
And just one final point on this. This has a bearing conceivably on a case that is unrelated to that Honor Code Investigation Office. There's a secondary sort of part of this, which is there was a video deposition or recording that BYU police made with former head of a missionary training center, mm-hmm, in Provo, right?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
We'll see how that plays out and whether that appeal works. Robert Gerke, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
Well, we've talked about this one a few times on this show. The prosecution of Rose Chilcote and her partner for the allegedly trying to kill this rancher's cattle by closing a gate. The rancher claimed that they would have starved. They were charged. The case against Rose this week was dismissed. The state attorneys who are handling the appeal for the county filed a motion to dismiss or didn't oppose a motion to dismiss, I guess. And so the charges against her are dropped. it was really kind of absurd that she was charged in the first place. They couldn't really prove that she had actually done anything wrong except be, you know, again, the partner of this person who is also charged with a crime. The case against him, and I'm blanking on his name right now, is going to proceed. So, you know, but there's been, you know, again, there's as we've discussed on this program before, the defense team on this has been is heavy hitters. Paul Cassell's involved, and you know, that we'll see how that one proceeds. But again, the case against Rose being dropped, I think, is probably a good thing.
All right, and you can check that out at sltrib.com. For my part, I'm going to go with the Utah Jazz canceling its contract with Papa John's Pizza. This is after the pizza chain came under fire following reports that its founder and CEO used the N-word during a company conference call, among other statements. And also came after the University of Louisville took the Papa John's name off of its football stadium. Utah Jazz rookie Donovan Mitchell on Twitter, by the way, suggested a new name for that stadium. He said they should rename it Muhammad Ali Stadium. So we'll see if that happens as well. Dan Harry, Salt Lake Tribune News and Politics Editor, and Robert Gerke, Salt Lake Tribune News Columnist. Thanks very much to both of you for being here.
Have a great weekend.
Thanks to Jesse Ellis here at KCPW and to the team at Utah Public Radio for helping make this show possible, as well as to the show's producer, Emily Means. Behind the Headlines is a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Roger McDonough. We'll see you next week.